How's your week, Dan? How did you get along thinking about people in a new way? Did you surprise anyone? Several years ago, I took a boy 12 and a half years old who had spent those first 12 years in and out of penal institutions. The psychologist said his case was hopeless, but I couldn't quite accept that. During the early months that I had him, he underwent quite a change from what he had been, so much so that at times, on the street, people didn't recognize him. He came in one evening just dying in laughter. The policeman, who had given him so much trouble so many times, hadn't recognized him. Not only did he have a new way to view himself, even the policeman saw him in a different way. A new way to look at people. It makes sense, doesn't it? But you know, it suggests an even broader view, which is the one I want to talk about in Exploration Number 7, a new way to think about what's real. Now, what do we mean when we talk about what's real? Two points of view emerge here. One is that death is the final reality. The other is that life is the final reality. Now, most of us live without ever making a solid decision either way. And consequently, most of us live with a rather bleak view of reality. Death is always lurking, not far from consciousness, casting its shadow across everything we do. We need a better way to view ourselves. In our last exploration, we looked at the way Jesus viewed a person. He saw them in a new way. He believed they had value, a value beyond their productivity. He didn't see us as marketable items to be thrown aside on a cosmic garbage heap when our usefulness to the workforce was over. No, the way he looked at people was so refreshing, he made us feel so good about ourselves that it makes us want to hear what he said about the final meaning of a person's life. Now, when he came into the world, everyone was pretty well mystified by this whole idea of death and afterlife. Oh, everyone had theories about why human life was the way it was, but no one spoke with much certainty, and no one seemed able to do anything more than just talk about it. It was at this point that he had such a dramatic impact on the people who knew him, because while they were impressed with what he said, they were more impressed by what he did. What he did backed up what he said. That's what made him such an unusual figure. It's rare to find that combination in anybody. Well, let's lay out the way Jesus viewed this whole question. The first point of view, that death is the final reality, was brilliantly stated by Bertrand Russell. His view was pretty pessimistic. He believed the causes that started man simply couldn't finish him, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and beliefs just happened rather than being planned. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labor of the ages, all the devotion, the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, he said, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. I think something close to this point of view is reflected in the song, Dust in the Wind. I close my eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity, dust in the wind. All they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, but we refuse to see. Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind. Now, I don't know about you, but that view leaves me just a little dry. With a load like that, no wonder we treat each other the way we do. No wonder we find it difficult to find an exciting reason to live. And no wonder we can hardly get out of bed in the morning. I mean, who could get excited about getting up to another day that was just going to bring you a little nearer to the great wipeout? And who could get excited about looking in the mirror, watching yourself fade away bit by bit? An Esquire article some time ago had on one page a big yes, and on the other page opposite, a big no. And then there was the question. If life had one question, what would your answer be? Yes or no? One writer was saying the answer was no, that life is awful, grimace, and bear it. And the other? He said the answer is yes. Life is God's novel. Help him write it. What is it that determines that yes or no? Well, it's the view you have of death. I mean, if death is viewed as final, of course the answer is no. But if life is viewed as final, then the answer can be yes. Sometimes it's pretty hard to know what we think about that, isn't it? And especially when you look at the world the way it is, all the suffering, all the tragedy that's in the world. I remember seeing a Broadway play called The Elephant Man. It was a play based on a historical character who lived in England in the 19th century. He was born into a very distorted and twisted, misshapen body that was horrible to look at. His body exuded a terrible odor. And for a time, he was a freak in a circus sideshow. And yet a doctor saw something of value in him and took him into a hospital where he was to live out the final years of his life. It soon became known that inside this misshaped body was a very bright, creative mind. But one day the doctor and the elephant man were talking about the nature of reality, the nature of the world, and where all the suffering, how it all fits in, and how a person such as the elephant man really fits into the fabric of reality. And the elephant man was giving his view and finally summarized his view by saying in his somewhat strained voice, "But I believe in heaven." And then as he looked, he began to see a little disbelief on the doctor's face. Anxiously, he looked at the doctor and said, Don't you believe in heaven?" The doctor said, "Merrick, all of that was at another age. It was in another world. It was fine in the days in which it was first announced and people first believed it. But look, we're living in a modern time, in a modern age, an age of technology. And those beliefs, they don't fit in anymore. They were fine in their day, but..." The elephant man continued to look at him, his anxiety obviously deepening, and he said again, "But don't you believe in heaven?" You see, unless there's an answer to death, his life was going to face a great big no. We have seen how death is at work in our everyday lives. Is there any hope? I mean, death works in us. It makes us fail. It makes us jealous and selfish and leaves us separated from one another, leaves us empty. We have seen that death is the only thing that stands between us and life. We have seen that we have no way to make ourselves alive, that success, games, even the religious games won't do it. We've seen our need for a new point of view, a new way of looking at things. Now, in Jesus' view, the problem in everyday life, as well as in the future, they were one and the same problem. We're struggling with death in a world of death. He described the failure we experience every day as a kind of death that was really keeping us from living. In his view, anything that keeps you from living in the fullest sense of the word, things like selfishness or pride or worry, that all of these things must be viewed very seriously because they rob us of life. They're killers of happiness, killers of peace of mind, killers of hope and optimism. No philosopher or student of human affairs had ever quite stated it that way. But Jesus not only said this is the truth about life, he even proposed to do something about it. He focused all his work at this point. He didn't hold the views that we are dust in the wind. He believed we are dust turned to hope. And if he fails to win at this point, then he takes his place alongside all the others who have seen the problem but were unable to do anything about it. On the other hand, if he succeeded in doing something about it, then certainly that is the most important fact of history. And so let's ask, how did he deal with it? Well, first, he saw death more as a disconnection than a final action. Death was a mere interruption of service. What we need if we are to live is some way to establish a reconnection, and that's what he called resurrection. Now, I'm aware of the problems of believing in the resurrection or reconnection on the one hand, and all the science and technology on the other. I know that our science and technology, they brought us a long way. We're splitting atoms, we're going to the moon, why, we're even making bombs. And I'm also aware of rising crime rates and soaring divorce rates and the general distrust in the land. Yes, I'm aware of our achievements. Many of them are scientific. But I'm also aware that while we've made life easier, we can hardly say we've made it better. In our figuring out how things work, have we really gained ground in answering why things work? And I think that science was never really intended to answer the why question, only the how. Science doesn't hold in itself the mystery of love, the power of hope, or the meaning of persons. It can analyze a tear, but it can't tell you why we cry. For all that science has helped us with, it has not been able to solve the central problem. Death. We still die. We still suffer. And from our spirits still proceed murder, cruelty, and discrimination. Now, what I believe we have here is two different fields of knowledge. Science and religion aren't competitors. They have different objectives, and it helps to keep this clear. Now, let's examine the relationship between our thirst for life and this view of Jesus on reconnection or resurrection. We sense in our hearts the possibility. Two caterpillars were crawling along between two rows of cabbage. One of them suddenly looked over to the other and said, "You know, one of these days I think I'll be able to have wings and we'll just fly over that fence and sip nectar from those flowers instead of just crawling along here and punching neat little holes in cabbage leaves all of my life." Well, his friend looked back at him and wrinkled his brow and scratched his head and really thought his friend had kind of flipped out. But one day, that caterpillar spun a little chrysalis. And then that chrysalis opened, and a beautiful, moist butterfly crawled out and took flight right over that fence and began to sip the nectar from those flowers. How can we, human beings, continue to live beyond the change that we call death? Is the cocoon of the grave our final place, or will we too emerge in an even greater dimension of life? Let's summarize what reconnection means. First, it's consistent with our desire to live. Don't you want to live? Your children want to live? There's a driving thirst in human life to live. We want to live. That's incontestable. We want to live, and yet we don't. How can we find life? How can we maintain life in a world of death? That's the question. And a resurrection squares with this terrific drive of all generations throughout all centuries and crossing all civilizations. We want to live. That's a fact. And that's what resurrection or reconnection is about. It's not about death. It's about life. And beyond that, isn't resurrection consistent with what we believe is in our future? Resurrection or reconnection is the only thing, really, that holds the possibility of opening the future. And we're all tremendously interested in what happens after death. That's why there's such interest in the writings of those who are studying the afterlife. We're interested in that. Why? What's out there? What's it like? Well, resurrection or reconnection says you will continue, that life continues, that your basic personality will continue, that death will not somehow destroy who you really are. We all kind of sense that, don't we? Well, all this says is that what you sense, that that's true. Resurrection says that all that we've kind of thought for all of these years, that it's simply true. It opens up the future. And beyond that, resurrection or reconnection says that life is the primary thing, that death really isn't the big event. Life's the big event. Life will have the final word. We usually think of death having the final word, but resurrection says, oh no, death won't have the final word. It's not the big event. Life is. And it has been all the time. Do you know that resurrection or reconnection says that death is temporary, that it's fleeting? We sometimes talk about life being a flickering candle. It's really the other way around. Death is the flickering candle. Life is the abiding issue. And all resurrection or reconnection says is that death will not rid us of life. That we have life and we can never be free from it. We can never rid ourselves from life even if we try, that we're forever. The decision we have to make is about the quality of that life. What kind of life will live forever? And will you feel good about it? And that brings us to our next point, which is that resurrection or reconnection, because it offers life, is somehow tied up with a power that's outside us that introduces a new quality of life into our situation. That's what we've been searching for. That's what this course is all about, feeling good about yourself. We know from whence we get biological life. We get biological life from our mothers and fathers, but we know that biological life by itself doesn't come with a built-in guarantee for quality. People who have biological life, these are the ones who are still jealous. They're still murdering. They're still robbing and killing. They're still being selfish. They're still doing all of those things. Biological life doesn't carry a guarantee for quality. But the life we're talking about now introduces quality into life. It says there is a life that you and I can have that has some effect on the way we view ourselves, that has some effect on the way we look at jealousy, some effect on our pride, on our selfishness, that this new quality of life throws all of this into a different light, and we're able to look at it in a different way. Now, part of the difficulty here is in imagining how in the world life could continue beyond death, as much as we want to believe that. It just seems so foreign to the way we think. So let's think about it for a moment. A baby lives about 9 months in its mother's womb prior to birth. What if a baby were conscious during that period? I mean conscious of itself and its situation, its environment. What if it sensed that at some point in the not-too-distant future, it was going to be evicted? Evicted from that nice, cozy place where it was living, and that its mother would be the one doing the evicting. Wouldn't the child perhaps be a little anxious about that? It's going to be disconnected. Its ties with the former place of living are going to be cut. It'll be a trying, shocking, traumatic experience, and there will be moments during which its service will be temporarily disconnected, and moments before it begins to breathe in its new environment. Will it survive? Then, after all the anxiety, comes the cry of life and hope. And it grows with a new sense of freedom and possibility. The time arrives when it wonders how it ever made it in that previous environment. Jesus saw death as that kind of transition, and each of us must decide whether it makes sense. Hi, how are you today? In our last exploration, we discussed a view of a possible reconnection to life beyond death. Now, that's exciting to think about, isn't it? And it squares with our greatest hopes. Now, it still leaves a lot to think about, a lot to fill in, but it does appear to be moving us in an exciting direction. And so we're now ready to take another step. Exploration 8, A Man Who Mastered Reality. We faced two hard issues in our explorations. The first one has to do with our lives, our final death, and the failure we experience in our everyday life. We don't know quite what to do with either of these. We only know they interfere with our desire to live. We don't know whether to go after an answer, if there is one, or simply drift along, vaguely hoping everything will turn out all right. The second dilemma we faced is the man called Jesus. What does a person in the 20th century do with him? I mean, can we believe that he somehow holds the keys to the question of our final death, as well as the failure we experience? Even if we're successful in getting him untangled from a lot of false religion, does that mean all the problems have been removed? I don't think so. A lot of hard problems remain. But I wonder why so many people continue to think about him. What is it about him that makes him so compelling? When you look back to his life, how in the world do you know what to make of it? People, for some reason, feel compelled to think about him. And I think part of that reason is he churned up nearly everything we've ever held on to as solid and real. He jumped right into the middle of a world with its neatly ordered patterns and challenged the way we think, the way we view ourselves, what we believe is important. In a sense, he just turned it all upside down. Now, people have done a lot of things, but few have ever touched reality as radically as he did. His birth. The Bible says he was born of a virgin. Now, what are you supposed to make of that? Is that believable? And his miracles. What are you going to make of the stories about him raising the dead? For one, his friend Lazarus, and for another, the son of a widow from a little Galilean village called Nain. And what are you going to do with the story of his opening the eyes of a man who had been blind since birth? According to the story, everyone was shocked, even his parents. Or the stories of the healing of the lame, the deaf, the palsied. What is a 20th century person to make of his walking on water or stilling raging storms? And that's to say nothing of his resurrection, which would mean he's still alive somewhere. Can a person believe all of this? Is he God's answer for human misery? Are people who have misshapen bodies, who live in hunger, people who are victims of injustice, the brutalized children, the raw deals, is this all just tough luck? Or does Jesus suggest, by opening blind eyes and curing leprosy and restoring sanity to troubled minds, that there's still another chapter to be written to the human story? Might there be some hope somewhere, somehow, for the sufferers of the world? The world seemed sure before Jesus came, but he shook all that up. And human nature. Can human beings be changed, or are we somehow caught in the maze of our own backgrounds, heredity, and personalities? Are some human beings simply no good, or is there hope for the worst? And are we to treat all human beings, regardless of the condition of body and mind, the same? Are we to make any difference? And look at religion. When he came, religion was a big, wealthy, hypocritical, sick institution that valued its rites and ceremonies and observances over people. Everyone felt then and now that little could be done about it. Jesus didn't feel that way. Took it all on, loved people in spite of it, incurred its anger and wrath, and finally was executed by it. Something in us seems to say that he was right. He's hard to be rid of sometimes. And death. He didn't even leave death alone. In fact, he majored in that. He said that was one of the two areas in which he had real expertise, the other being life. And solutions? Nearly everyone feels the solutions to human problems lies somewhere in money, fame, power, science. But when we think of these things, we think of reigning kings and presidents or atom bombs or spaceships. And yet, he went in the opposite direction, made a cross his symbol of hope. Now, what's a person today supposed to do with the cross? To see it simply as a place of execution, like an electric chair or a hanging rope, or as a symbol of love and hope for a suffering world? Did death win that day, killing him forever? Or are the accounts true that he was seen alive by hundreds a few days later? Now, these are some of the reasons Jesus retained such a central place in human thought. Because these happen to be the toughest issues human beings have ever faced. And along comes Jesus, takes them all on with a calmness and a certainty that left the people speechless. And to make it even more difficult, he never lost sight of the persons around him. In fact, he had time for them regardless of his schedule. He stayed with the ones who were hurting, the ones who suffered from guilt and fear. His own hands were bloody from the help and counsel and comfort he gave out every day. Nobody can quite pin the label of a starry-eyed dreamer on him and hence make us rid of him, or a demented would-be king so that we don't have to fool with him anymore. No, he was too close to us, too close to the people. He dealt too closely with the issues. It makes it difficult to simply write him off. And when he was challenged by either friend or foe, have you ever noticed the way he answered? He wouldn't answer with lofty titles or make speeches about his identity. He would simply turn from the questioner and continue his work with the people, and then turn around and say, "Now you go back and tell the doubters what you're seeing happen." Perhaps as incredible as anything else is the way he provided for the continuation of his work. Chose a dozen men, fishermen and the like. Men who ran away when he was arrested as the ones who would carry on his work. And though frightened at first, they came back. And all of them believed so strongly that he was alive, they spent the rest of their lives spreading what they called the good news of forgiveness. All of them but one dying violent deaths because they believed. Even a man named Paul, a brilliant mind, one who is being recognized more and more as the man who probably has influenced Western civilization more than anyone who's ever lived, a man who began by dealing out all the misery to the followers of Jesus he could, even to the point of killing them, and yet one who became so completely convinced that Jesus was real that his life turned completely around and he became the most prominent messenger throughout the world. So deeply affected was this man that his credo was, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Now these are some of the reasons we're perplexed today. We know what our problems are. We also know that Jesus concentrated his whole life on doing something about those very specific problems. What we hadn't anticipated was the seriousness and depth of both the problem and the solution as Jesus saw them. We weren't quite ready for anything this shocking and drastic. I guess we all thought death could be handled in a much simpler way, with white gloves. We only wanted a little sentimental cosmetic work done on the failure of our lives. One man said, "You know, it's kind of strange. Everyone talked for years about wanting to do something about the failure they had to live with every day. And they talked for years about..." And they talked for years about wanting something done about the problem of death. And then someone came along and did something about both of them, and everybody said, oh no, that's not the way we thought it ought to be done. If it has to be done that way, we're not interested. Have we somehow missed the point? To answer this, the first thing we have to do is be sure we understand what's being said and not be like the problem drinker I heard about. A man was talking to a group of problem drinkers, and he was giving an illustration. He took a beaker of alcohol and put a live worm down in the alcohol, and of course the worm just dissolved. And he asked the question, now, what does this show? And from the back of the room, a fellow raised his feet and said, well, it just proves that if you drink a lot, you'll never have any worms. It really comes down to a very personal decision. Here's what you can think about. Can you feel good about yourself without an answer for failure and death? Can your life be as full and as free and as rich? Your answer and your decision will grow out of this reasoning. You must weigh Jesus' life and story, and then decide whether you believe he had the answer for failure and death. And if your answer is yes, then you can consider the impact of that answer on your life. And if your answer is no, you'll at least know that you've thought it through and you've made a rational decision at the right point. And if your answer is, I don't know, then continue to pursue the matter. Perhaps Goethe summed it all up when he put it this way, as long as you do not know how to die and come to life again, you are but a sorry traveler on this dark earth. And yet, Pascal talks about a different kind of traveler when he said, it's great to be in a ship on a storm-tossed sea when you're sure the ship won't sink. My deepest wish for you is that in your explorations and journey that you'll be a happy traveler, that you'll be feeling good about yourself. Hi, I hope you've had a good week. We've been attempting for the last several weeks to get a clearer perspective on what it takes for us to feel good about ourselves. Now, when you get right down to it, solving one or two little problems probably won't make us feel good about ourselves, at least for very long. A new problem would simply arise tomorrow. No, what we need more than instant solutions is a way to deal with life as it comes at us, effectively enough that we feel good about ourselves. I want to feel good about myself if I fail, and I want to feel good about myself if I get a terminal disease, and I want to feel good about myself if I'm at the little end of a bad deal, if I'm rejected. We have no real protection against these things. These are realities that I have to deal with. Now, this is exploration number 9, mastering the realities of your everyday life. Now, that title may not excite you. Master realities? For most people, it's just tell me how I can get through the night. Frank Sinatra said, I'm for anything that'll get you through the night, be it a bottle of Jack Daniels or pills or prayer. Someone else said that one of the first things you have to do to become a master of reality is to turn in your resignation as the boss of the universe. It'll be quickly accepted, and this will give you the time and energy then that you need to do other things. Well, suppose you had mastered reality. What would life be like each day? Would everything be pie in the sky, no more troubles, no more commodes running over, or no more cars that wouldn't start, no more water pipes bursting? No. No, much would be the same. First, when you get up in the morning and look in the mirror, you would see the same physical characteristics you saw this morning. Same hair, the same baldness, wrinkles, acne, whatever. And you'll be in the same family. You'll have the same mate, the same children, the same roommate. You'll get up to go to the same job, drive the same car, get on the same bus and subway, see the same people, still meet the same problems. The headlines on tomorrow's paper, they won't be any different. And your birthday will still come around once every year. And your bills, they'll still be in the mailbox. And you'll still be vulnerable to sickness and aging and dying. So what's new? What's changed? You have? And that's a big change. It's really the only way any of us have of changing the world. Because you see, when you've changed the world. You see, you and I, we're a part of the reality of things. I'm real. You're real. I'm alive. I am here since I'm a part of the reality. And if I've changed, then reality has changed. That's pretty major, isn't it? Yeah? The change is inside you. And that's the most important change of all. You would get up from now on knowing you were alive and not dead. And you'd know that you're accepted, secure, loved, forgiven. You'll know you're in touch with what's real. And because you're in touch with that reality, you can survive absolutely anything that comes your way. You'll know that nothing can stop you. You can survive and defeat any failure. Any mistake you make is forgivable. And you'll know that even if you drop in the midst of your workday, all is well, you could die without being embarrassed. And you'll understand some other things, like the nature of reality. You know that some people don't know what's wrong in the world. They don't know why the world is the way it is. But you'll know. You'll know why people have problems. And you'll know why those problems won't go away. You'll understand more about why people do the things they do. And why there's so much heartache in the world. Why there's so much hurt. This can't help but reduce the fear that you've been carrying around. And if you understand it, you see, then you're not as afraid. It'll give you a new sense of certainty, a new confidence that somehow you've missed before. In other words, you'll be a new person. You'd see everything differently because now you have a new point of view. And there's still more, the basis for all your relationships. Do you know that that basis will be changed? The basis now will be forgiveness. Nothing works harder to strengthen relationships, to bring people together, than forgiveness. Why, it'll break down absolutely any barrier that has ever existed between two persons. What usually happens is, we go away, we feel sorry for ourselves, we feel we've been treated wrongly. We harbor grudges, bitterness, and hurt, things that separate us from one another. Many lives are nothing more than a long series of broken relationships. And there are few things more damaging to the human spirit, the self-image, than this. But all that can change. You would no longer demand that others do exactly as you want them to do. Think you could ever do that? You say, I don't even know if I want to do that. Well, you'll have to admit it is a pretty dynamic possibility. The possibility that you would no longer demand that others do and be exactly as you think they should do and be. Listen, it takes an awful lot of energy trying to get everybody to do just like you think they ought to do. And especially when you realize that you'll never succeed anyway. You see, people don't have to be perfect, because no matter what they do, now you can relate to them. Forgiveness, it prevents those barriers from arising, and it'll keep the communication lines open. There's nothing that can happen between you that has more power than forgiveness. Now, let's go back to the five tests that tell us whether we're winning or losing again. See if we're making any progress on finding a winning life. The first test said that we must live for something that circumstances couldn't destroy. Now, if you could live your life every day feeling good about yourself, knowing that any failure in you can be forgiven, and knowing that no circumstances could make you feel bad about yourself because you now know that you'll live regardless of whether those water pipes burst or a relationship folds or a job is lost, you have tapped life. And you know your life is important and it's permanent and nothing will ever take it away from you or prevent you from having it forever. The second test. It says that whatever you live for mustn't be something that death can destroy. If you knew your life was permanent, that death was nothing more than a temporary disconnection, wouldn't that make you feel a lot better about what you were doing? Now, if what you're doing is real, if death has no power over it, you'll be doing something that will live regardless of what happens to you. You would know that death has been declared a second-rate power. It's been defeated. It's been mastered. And so you don't live all day, every day, in fear of death. You know, if you're doing something significant, something that death just can't walk in and destroy, the thing that you've been pursuing all those years of your life, my... Don't you know that'll make you feel better? It just helps to know what death's real place is, what its limitations are, and then we're free to live without so much fear. The third test. The third test was to live for something for which you would be willing to die. Wouldn't you love to live for something that was so important that you would gladly give your life for it? I think a soldier in war feels a little of this. He's still afraid, and yet the knowledge that what he's doing is so important that it puts a little different light on the danger of death. I have some friends who knew a young woman whose parents had given their lives for. And when she had been a baby, she was in the back seat of the car, her parents in the front. They were on a train crossing, the car stalled. And they kept trying to start the car. An approaching train was coming faster than they realized until the moment they knew they couldn't get out themselves and save the baby. They made a decision. They went for their little girl, threw her out the window of the car, and were killed themselves. That girl lives today to find out everything she can find out about her parents. They had something worth giving their lives for, and she was grateful. Now, you may not have this something to live for clearly defined yet, but remember, you're beginning to sense the possibility, and that's the important thing. Don't give up. The fourth test. The fourth test is to have something that will enhance all your relationships. Now, if you had mastered reality, you would have mastered the guilt and fear and insecurity and pride and selfishness that mar or destroy relationships. At least you would know how to deal with them in a way that would curb their destructiveness. As a master of reality, you would have a new view, this new way of looking at people, which would strengthen your relationships. You would see your relationship to your work. You'd see that in a different way. You'd view your boss differently. And your secretary, you would even view the people who have tried to do you in a different way. People have new value to you, new importance. At home, you would see your family differently, your wife, your husband, your children, your parents. Nothing in the world is as important to you as a person. Nothing will improve your relationships more than living this out in your life. The fifth test is the guarantee of constant improvement. Why, with failure under control and death conquered, can you imagine being free enough to go on growing, risking, and loving as long as you live? The thing that will guarantee this improvement is your new understanding of love. Love is needed by all of us. Nothing encourages us as much as love. You'll never outgrow love. You'll never wear it out. Love is the atmosphere in which a human being can grow and flourish the best. Live in love, and you'll always be improving. Solzhenitsyn wrote a novel called Cancer Ward, and one of the dying men picks up a book entitled What Men Live By. He was intrigued by that question. What do men live by? Until he'd been stricken with cancer, he had lived to work. And the party boss said, men live for their ideology. And still another said, men live for their pay. Then he came to the place in the book that answered the question. People live not by worrying only about their own problems, but by love of others. Well, all of that sounds good, people sometimes say. In fact, too good. A couple of suggestions. First, consider what your options are. Do you feel good about yourself now? Are you satisfied with your life? Do you know what your life is about? If you're content, you may not want to exercise any option. But if you're not satisfied, then at some point you must decide to take some kind of action. I'm simply urging you to think through these questions like failure and death, and don't rest until you've thought them through and made some decisions. And second, you may want to simply try out some of these things for a while. See if they work. Give them adequate time, but work with them. That's one of the best ways to think them through. This week, try to get some idea of where your own feelings are. What are the things that most impress you about this? What are the unresolved questions? And if you feel a little more tension inside yourself, just be thankful for it. It means you're stretching and growing. Whatever you do, don't give up, because life is for those who reach out for it with both hands.